This is URN.
The Popular Table Breakdown.
Thanks very much for coming in, Becky. Starting us off, how did primary get started? Could you give us a bit of a brief history on that?
Yeah, sure. So Primary is an artist studios and an arts venue that's in an amazing building on Ilkeston Road, which is the old Douglas Primary School. And it was set up by Nottingham Studios Limited, who is a group of artists who were looking for many years for a location to set up a more permanent studios and somewhere that had a bit more security for artists working in the city. So they eventually found this building and signed a lease with the city council, so they got it for 30 years, which is kind of really unusual to have that length of time to work with a building. So that's kind of where it came from, and then it's been in that building for about 4 years now, and we've got more than 30 artists and designers and other businesses set up in there, and we also run a public program now.
What kind of projects does Primary get involved with, and what do we have to look forward to in the coming months?
Well, the public programme we launched it just under 2 years ago, and that's curated by myself and Nikki Russell. And the main focus for the programme is around inviting artists and others who they might collaborate with to really have the space to kind of experiment, test out ideas, not necessarily working towards a solid end product. So we don't really have an exhibitions programme as such. It's much more seeing it as an extension of what the studios are, what an artist studio is, in that it's a space for people to experiment, test ideas, maybe push some boundaries and have a bit of time and space. So we, through the public programme, we invite different artists to come and do commissions as part of our programme, and those can play out as experiments with materials in terms of sculpture and performance inside our project spaces. And also there's a programme I've been running over the last 2 years called Intersections, which is involved inviting different artists to respond in some way to the locality around Primary. So one of the more recent projects, which you were actually involved in as part of a really fantastic event that we did at the end of the project, was called it was with an artist called Sonia Dyer. And Sonia proposed bringing her peripatetic think tank, which is called the And Beyond Institute for Future Research, to Nottingham. And she brought the think tank to Nottingham. She invited, put out an open call really for women who were interested in space travel and in imagining the future to join that group. And over kind of a series of conversations and workshops, we found 6 people who were really excited about being involved in the project. So, and that kind of manifested in further workshops and then a public event, which was a series of workshops and a discussion around different ways we might imagine the future. So I guess it's quite an unusual way for an artist to work. It's not perhaps what you might first imagine when you think about an art project, but obviously contemporary artists work in all sorts of ways and collaborate across disciplines, and I think Sonia's project was a really fantastic example of really kind of pushing the boundaries of how and why and what we imagine, and asking who gets to imagine. So in terms of projects we've got coming up, right now we're working with the third Intersections Commission, which is with Emma Smith, and she's recently had a first public event, which is in conversation with Marek Korzynski, who's a professor here at the university. So they were looking at the significance of music and singing and whistling in places of work, both around both kind of bringing people together, but also resistance and protest. And Emma's project will be building up with participants over the next few months. So if anyone's interested in getting involved, they should get in touch. And the end point of that will be a performance by a whistling orchestra based on the research they've been doing together.
Do you find that running a group like Primary provides an outlet for engaging with new and kind of innovative ways of art? Because as you said, the type of projects you've just described wouldn't be the stereotypical image that someone would have of an art commission or an art project? And does that, that provides a really exciting avenue, I think, and does that really, or I should probably rephrase that, how does that help reach out to the wider community in Nottingham?
Okay, I guess there's two parts to that question. Mm-hmm. One is about, you know, what is art? I think, you know, working in contemporary arts nowadays, you really do see people working across all kinds of disciplines. And if you take a look at the artists who are based at Primary as resident artists, you have studios there, you have people making amazing paintings and you have people working in sculpture, but you also have people doing performance work in public. We have people who work with sound or video. And often there are collaborations across, you know, the artists kind of working with people who are from other backgrounds, and sort of weaving in the knowledge and expertise that they might bring. So to me, I think art already is a very, very wide spectrum. And I think in terms of the projects that we're doing that are working with wider communities around where Primary is based, one of the main focuses that I'm really interested in is how you invite people to share their own knowledge, their own culture making, their own expertise within a project. I think there's, you know, there's a history of really fantastic art in public places and also community arts, with some really amazing projects that have happened, you know, since the 60s and before. But there's also, there can be a tendency to kind of do art to people, and we really want to avoid that. So rather than saying we're going to kind of plonk an art project on you, we're trying to find ways to create a community of interest around the way that different artists and others may be working.
What about Nottingham makes it such a good place to situate Primary?
I guess Primary's kind of grown out of Nottingham, mm-hmm. rather than deciding to be in Nottingham, if that makes sense. So it's grown out of a group of artists who've been long-term based in the city, and it's only one of many really fantastic studio projects and artist-led projects in the city. So I think Nottingham is quite unique in the sense of, for a city its size, it's got an extremely strong artist-led sector. There's a lot of people who do the fine art course and other courses at Nottingham Trent University who stay in the city, and I think they stay because there's already a lot of people doing interesting stuff here, and they stay because there's opportunities to set up new projects. And in my experience, the culture of the kind of creative scene in Nottingham is really collaborative and supportive, and you know, it's possible to do things here and it's possible to make things happen. And it's a small enough city that people kind of share their experiences. And I just mentioned a few of the other kind of projects that are happening around the city. So Primary is probably one of the newer big studio complexes that's been set up. Down in Snenton, you've got One Thoresby Street and Backlit. There's also the Surface Gallery, which is a fantastic volunteer-run space that has a gallery and also studio spaces. And that's just to mention a few, really. So it's a strong network, and yeah, I think that's why it's such a great place to be based.
Do you think that culture carries a lot more potential for shaping social norms? Or you worked with a project on imagining the future. So does culture provide more exciting ways and perhaps more accessible ways to engage with these social concerns than people give it credit for?
I would say yes, definitely. And that's, you know, obviously coming from my perspective, and what I'm trying to do within Primary, but also as an artist myself. I wouldn't say that all artists might think that. I think, you know, there's definitely very valid questions around the kind of instrumentalization of art and culture. So, yeah, I don't think anyone produces anything in a vacuum. I think that, therefore, you know, no kind of cultural production is apolitical or isn't touched by the social realities that you're functioning in. I don't think that all cultural production or, you know, art or culture has to try and make a change or have an impact. But I think it does. I think we're massively influenced by what we see and hear on a daily basis, you know, and I think there's a huge power in questioning the kind of the things that we swallow without thinking about. So the images that are constantly presented to us, you know, the way that we think is, I think this is something that art has a real potential around. There are ways that you think which you don't even realise you're thinking until something really interrupts them. And it's very difficult to unlearn some of those very embedded things. And I think culture, art, or however, whatever you want to call it, those sorts of experiences are the times most often for me when you are shifted, and much more so than, you know, perhaps just kind of being presented with something as a news article.
Have you been to the castle before?
Well, I just live down the road, so I've been when I was little, but I go for like the fireworks in New Year and stuff.
Wow, what's that like?
It's really good. The displays are really big and really, really good.
What's it like living right by the castle?
It's really useful because it's really easy to get to town shopping and meet your friends.
And what was the highlight when you went to the castle when you were younger, if you can remember?
Seeing all the fields, like all the flowers, like they just go on forever.
So what do you love about the castle?
I love that it's one of the only castles in Nottingham, and it's close to the city centre, and it provides the beer festival, which is always good.
What do you love about working right by Nottingham Castle?
It's quite good to get like quite a lot of tourists that come in who go to the castle. There's quite a lot of events up there, like the Nottingham Beer Festival every year. They do the light night, which is quite good.
Have you been to Nottingham Castle before?
I haven't, no, not to visit the castle. I've been to the beer festival, though, in the grounds, and it's lovely. I do desperately want to visit. I mean, I was at university here as well, and they say it's a good thing to do with your parents when your parents come and visit.
Have you been to the Nottingham Castle before?
I have, yes.
And how often do you visit?
Not very often. It's very infrequently. It's usually like maybe a couple of times a year. We go every year for the beer festival, every now and then for the sketch crawl. We go on once a month, but that's it really. I should go more often because it's right here. But
what's the sketch crawl you do?
It's just a bunch of people just meet up and draw, really. That's generally it.
And what's the highlight of the castle?
The highlight of the castle is probably the gallery for me. It's a very nice gallery. Got some nice work in there. Yeah, no, it's cool.
And what do you tend to sketch when you visit?
It depends. Depends whether. When it's nice, usually sketchy outside. There's loads inside, though. There's like, you know, they've got like a history bit, you know, with loads of like old war stuff. So yeah, anything I fancy, really.
And how was the beer festival when you've been?
It's pretty good. Yeah, I always enjoy the beer festival. As you can tell, I like a beer. So yeah, it's good. Yeah.
It's a little bit more modern inside now, whereas when I was a child, there's lots of interesting things like coaches and the armour, the soldiers, and that it's not there now, and that would be interesting to children as well. There's a lot of artwork there now. Some years ago they had by Robin Hood statue a show going on with artists singing 1950s music and hip-hop dancing, and it was really enjoyable. They're improving the area around the castle with the restaurants and the real ale pubs. It's nice to be up this end of town.
What do you think about Nottingham Castle?
It's a good attraction. It brings in a lot of people to businesses around the local area.
What's it like working right next to the castle?
A bit stressful. When it's summer times, it gets very, very busy. But there's a lot of tourists. Yeah, it's entertaining. Yeah, you see a lot of things outside, like jousting. And we have the beer festival every year as well. So, it's a good attraction. It's quite expensive to go in, to be fair. Say it's Robin Hood and it's a local hero, supposedly. It's like £6. Is it £6 to get in or something like that? And yeah, quite expensive for children. So yeah, you don't really see any from outside. You can hear a lot of music inside, like Friday and Saturday nights when they've got events on. You don't really know what's going on inside, to be fair.
What's it like working right by the castle?
It's good. It has its advantages. Get to meet lots of tourists internationally. Yeah.
And what's it like working right by the castle?
It's good. Yeah, it's good. It gets people into the cafe, so.
And have you visited before?
No, never.
And is there a reason?
Well, we went in, we didn't realise there was an admission fee when we first went, so we went in there, we were just going to have a quick look around, but then we had to pay to get in, so we decided not to.
Have you visited the castle before?
No, I haven't, no.
Do you come past here a lot?
Yeah, almost every day, actually, on the way to work, yeah.
Is there a reason you haven't visited yet?
Mainly just the price, really. It's a bit expensive, but no, yeah, that's it, really. Yeah.
Quite a few people have been saying that. Is there anything that would make you visit?
I reckon maybe just Do you look a 2-for-1 for maybe just some weekends? That would help. That'd be great.
I think they're doing a Christmas weekend with free entry with that temp tune.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that would be great, yeah.
I'm with Dr. Rob Lutton, who is a professor in medieval history at the University of Nottingham, and we're going to talk about Robin Hood. But I think we're going to start with the big question, the question that's on all of our minds. Did Robin Hood exist? Was he real?
Somehow I knew you were going to start with that question, Shivani, and it's a good question. It's the question we all want to ask. As we think of Robin Hood as a heroic figure, and as he's talked about and written about in the later Middle Ages, which is the period I work on, then I'm sorry to disappoint your listeners, but no, he didn't exist. There may have been an originating historical figure, a criminal, an outlaw. There's some early 13th century references to someone called Robert of Wetherby, who was hanged in 1225 by the Sheriff of Yorkshire, an evildoer, outlaw and evildoer of our land. That's how he's described. Now, he's also described in those records as Rob Hod and Robert Hood. So he might have given rise to stories that circulated around him as an individual. But, you know, we know nothing else about him, really. And the figure in the stories that emerges by the 14th and 15th centuries is very romanticised and very idealised. These are stories, essentially.
If Robin Hood didn't really exist, you said that there was someone who could have been the basis of these Robin Hood stories. Was this common in this era?
It is common, and the really interesting thing that we find in other royal records, these are criminal records, you know, where people are brought to trial for being naughty, essentially for being outlaws and engaging in criminal activity. The really interesting thing we find within a generation of that reference is that the name Robin Hood, Rob Hod, Robert Hood and Little John is being used as a sort of jokey nickname by criminals and by the people who keep these records. So in one instance, they changed the name of one of these individuals to Rob Hod. So it's become a criminal moniker, if you like, which suggests that there are stories circulating at that point within a generation of that early 13th century record. And these are probably in popular oral culture. But there are a lot of these outlaw figures. So in the 14th century, which is probably more the time that more likely to be the time that the late medieval ballads of Robin Hood get written and composed, there are these amazing criminal gangs like the Cotterills and the Fovilles. They sound like Wild West gangs, and in some ways they inform the way we think about the Wild West as well, because there's a long tradition of outlawry and banditry. But they are, you know, they're gangs of really lower gentry. They're quite well-to-do, but they're really not very pleasant individuals. Groups of brothers who go in and out of military service. They engage in felony and extortion and robbery and kidnap and murder. And they seem to successfully get away with this, partly because they end up fighting for the king again, who then pardons them because he basically needs people in his armies. So they're really extraordinary figures, and we know quite a lot about them. So, yeah, there are outlaws that sort of approximate to how Robin Hood is talked about in the medieval legend.
So Robin Hood was almost like an alias figure for all outlaws.
Yeah, he is, but he's also idealised. I mean, the thing I really like about the late medieval Robin Hood is he's quite dark and dangerous. So there's this little story in the ballad Robin Hood and the Monk where they kill, Robin and his men kill the monk's servant boy. I mean, it's really unpleasant stuff. It's quite dark and nasty. There's another episode in Robin Hood and Guy of Gisborne where he kills Guy, mutilates his face, cuts the head off and sticks it on a pole as a statement of his triumph over his adversary. So there's some quite dark stuff in there. But he's also an idealist. So he sticks up for the little person. He's quite prepared to rob abbots and bishops and archbishops and noblemen, but he talks, there's this sort of code in the ballads where they talk about not stealing from husbandmen and from women and from the downtrodden, basically. But at the same time, the medieval Robin Hood doesn't steal to give to the poor. He doesn't rob the rich to give to the poor. That's a later invention. They steal from the rich to dish it out amongst themselves. And if someone comes along who's in need, then they'll help them out, but only as that arises in the stories. So he's a really interesting mixture of moral idealism, who knows the difference between right and wrong, but also this sort of nasty criminal subculture, if you like.
Have you got any opinions on Robin Hood shows or programmes or anything like that? Do you watch or listen to any of those kind of things now?
I'm going to sound like a really grumpy historian now. I remember watching the more recent BBC Robin Hood series, I think when that started out, which was probably longer ago than I care to remember now. But getting, it's difficult for me watching those sorts of takes on the legend. And I did find it quite frustrating. But I like the way that they dealt with the whole issues about war and post-traumatic stress disorder, which I think are factors in those stories in the later Middle Ages where people have been fighting in the Hundred Years' War, for example. So they got some really interesting current issues in there about religious faith and religious difference, which was really, really good. But my favourite Robin Hood film is Robin and Marian, which is a Richard Lester British-made film with Sean Connery and Katharine Hepburn, which is... It's really cheesy in some ways, but it's fantastically melancholy. And it's got some really, really good subtleties to it and kind of gets the legend to some extent as well. So I like that one. I'd recommend that one.
How important do you think it is to educate people about Robin Hood and the Robin Hood era, and not just educate them on the era, but educate them the way we do kind of through fictitious stories?
Well, I mean, it's important to be aware that Robin Hood remains part of our popular culture and to ask questions about why that is. And I think in the current environment, there are some really interesting parallels to the Robin Hood in the Middle Ages who stands up against external authorities, sticks up for the community, for the small person, you know, sticks it to the man. So there have been some interesting parallels in recent documentaries on Robin Hood about Occupy, and about those anti-capitalist movements. Robin Hood isn't anti-capitalist, but he's still standing up against external authority and external authorities that want to control us in some way. So there are interesting parallels there that I think we ought to be aware of, and also to think about how these traditions change over time and how they get reworked according to our current concerns. And that will keep going. I don't think Robin Hood doesn't look like he's going away. So he's been a vehicle for exploring these sorts of issues for a very long time. And I think it's good to be aware of that. And also to be aware of how of our own misconceptions. We would all really like him to have existed. But what's more interesting is what he stands for. That's more interesting in the later Middle Ages, the period I study, than whether or not he really existed. And what he stands for now, to me.
Why is Robin Hood so closely linked with Nottingham? Why do we have Robin Hood statues and everyone thinks of Robin Hood when they come here? So why is that?
Well, Nottingham is named, and Sherwood Forest and the city of Nottingham are named in those earliest Robin Hood stories, the earliest stories we have, which were probably composed in the 14th century, first written down in the 15th century. Those stories, and this is a kind of point of contention, also mention Barnsdale, which is between Doncaster and Wakefield, which is why Doncaster Airport is called Robin Hood Airport. And when they named it Robin Hood Airport, the people of Nottinghamshire and of Nottingham got a bit upset about this and said, "You're trying to steal our Robin Hood." The truth is, he's always been a North Midlands and Northern hero, you know, attached to South Yorkshire and attached to Nottinghamshire. But, you know, he's big enough to be shared between the two places. And you know, because Nottingham's named and Sherwood Forest are actually named in those stories, he will always be associated with Nottingham.
Do you know if there's anywhere particularly linked to history, if people are interested in seeing kind of where Robin Hood has come from? Do you know of any attractions around Nottingham or...?
There's the visitor centre in Sherwood Forest. We used to have a visitor centre in Nottingham that was focused on Robin Hood. We don't at the moment. There have been plans underfoot for some time by the city council to create something in the precincts of the castle. In these current times of austerity, I'm not sure that's happening anytime soon. But we do need something in Nottingham. We need, you know, we need some sort of focus other than the statue. And I quite like the statue outside the castle. You know, we need something more than that that people can come to. There's a good website. It's of the Worldwide Robin Hood Society, which is really easy to find online, which it brings together a lot of the more popular stuff, but also the more scholarly academic side of the legend. And if someone wanted to start, you know, delving into Robin Hood, then that's a good place to look. And there's also a really good book by someone called Tony Pollard, who's a historian of late medieval England, Imagining Robin Hood. And that's really good if anyone's interested in reading about the late medieval legend.